Welcome to the Get Together.
All over the world, there are people thinking about and creating a future of live digital events and performances.
They're disparate innovators who are artists, tech founders, nonprofits, and investors, and they need a place to gather and share ideas.
That's what the Get Together is all about.
I'm Jess, a theater creator who loves bringing people together around technology, art, and the internet.
And I'm Joe, a tech and media startup vet with over 10 years of experience growing and operating businesses.
Thanks for getting together with us. Let's dig in. It's just a mess over there, Joe.
I was actually thinking about this last night. Like, I had like a series of just like stupid, like I like bruised my rib and then I got that weird rash and then I got COVID. Yeah. It's just like a stream of like weird, not really major medical maladies that are just like annoying. And I was like, can I just be like healthy for a couple of days?
Oh, bub, is ease. And yeah. Also, so for you all listening, like before we started recording, I was looking at the script, so I wasn't looking at Zoom. And then I just heard like crashes like a couple of times.
Maybe that's why my audio's off, because I dropped my microphone.
That could be it. So you got the Rona, huh?
I do currently have COVID-19.
Oh, man.
I'm 2 days in.
She got
a little
you.
Sniffly.
1 year anniversary.
Little scratchy
of our vaccine. Oh, you and I got
so
vaccinated
true.
This week
like on the 28th, 29th of last year. Man. So true. I've gotten 3 shots since then and still got sick. Fairly mild though.
I have a random question for you that I was thinking about on this. Like, you know how sometimes you ask me like what my read is, what my bet is on things.
Yeah.
How do you think COVID-19 in its current form, right, which is less deadly overall, but still seeming to disrupt in-person live events. Like, how do you think that is going to impact the way we plan across the next couple of years? I'm curious to know what you think, because I feel like there's a camp that's like, we got to do it all and have 10 backups. And then there's a camp that's like, fuck this, I don't need any backups. And if we have to cancel it all, we cancel it all. So I'm just like curious what you think about it, because we're in the middle of this like huge disruption, right? Like for everyone, because you got COVID.
I'm the worst.
I was like, oh no, this is not sounding the way I want it to sound.
You saved it right there at the end. I was just about to shut my laptop and storm off to the other room in my apartment. with all the necessary and obvious caveats of neither of us are epidemiologists, neither of us really knows what we're talking about when it comes to communicable diseases. But we do know events, and we can speak with a little bit of authority there. I think it'll be some combination of everything that you just threw out there, that it'll be a coronavirus and COVID-19 and being sick with it, and... like, I think, you know, for example, I just ran this past weekend the Brooklyn Half Marathon.
You're a hero. With COVID, probably.
Yeah, who knows? I felt fine that day, and then the next day I was sick. And that, you know, that race, that event was obviously scheduled, like, way out in advance. But then there was another, like, small surge in cases with the latest variant of the Omicron virus. And they, like, didn't shut down the race. They didn't require any new testing. They didn't, like, need or do anything that would have been, you know, standard or required a year ago, 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Even though there is, like, currently in New York City, like, a slight increase, I believe, in the number of cases that are being reported. And so, yeah, if you looked back a year and took that same scenario, that race probably would have gotten canceled. Or there would have been some more stringent sort of requirement around showing proof of vaccination and or having some sort of a test that's in the 72 hours leading up to this, you know, mass event. Mm-hmm. And there just wasn't really any of that. Like, I got there, I stood on a line that was the wrong line with, you know, 1,000 other people.
Oh, good.
And then I got into another line, and at no point was anyone checking vaccinations or anything like that.
Wow.
And I think that's like a representation of sort of where we're going culturally. It's like, hey, everyone has just sort of either had it and therefore slightly desensitized to it, or just fucking over it and therefore slightly desensitized to it, with a slight like resignation to being like, maybe I'll get it and hopefully it'll be fine. You know, I think that that world sounds hard for people who are like immunocompromised and aren't like, you know, don't have that luxury. But I feel like we're already trending that direction. I could see it continuing to go that direction of just people just not wanting to think about it or worry about it in the same way that we did across the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still obviously existing. And back to us not being epidemiologists.
What?
The sort of difference between pandemic and endemic. And I sort of, you know, I know like the flu is endemic. It comes in cycles. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why right now the arguments that COVID is turning into an endemic virus is not right. Like I've heard and I've read that, but I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. But I do think we are starting to treat it as if it's just the flu.
Mm-hmm.
We've all just become Republicans. So I think that'll be one big important factor, that like, because the people going to the events and probably the people putting on the events will be like, we just got a bit more risk tolerance for this thing because we have more understanding of it. People are vaccinated, or at least vaccination is an option. There's all those other medicines, like I think it's called Paxlovid, the new Pfizer drug for helping to sort of reduce hospitalization and death in people who do have COVID.
Mm.
So things like that, more and more remedies. And so everyone's tolerance will go up and fewer things will get canceled and more events will happen and people will be less worried about throwing the super spreader event of the millennium.
Yeah, that's fair. So we just wrapped up the New York Crime Victims Candlelight Vigil, which is in its 37th year, which is wild. So, and it happens during National Crime Victims Rights Week every year. And in New York, it's quite a big vigil. It happens on the Upper West Side and all of our district attorneys speak at it and survivors speak. And it's just this incredible event that I was introduced to through my work with the Get Back concert. And a couple of years ago when COVID hit, they asked us to help them take the vigil digital. And it's sort of, you know, I think just from the committee's feedback to us, sort of really, really revolutionized and changed in their eyes what could be with the vigil. Because all of a sudden, this really important, beautiful event that brings so much comfort and to survivors, that promises, you know, so much action by legislators and by folks in government offices, was reaching 5 times the amount of people that I was reaching when it was in person. And so this year, when it was clear that we could come back to in person, they asked us to help make it a hybrid event, which was really exciting. And so that's what we've been doing. And that's what we just finished. And we had wild like analytics coming out of that on the digital side, which I thought were really, really interesting. You know, they think they had about 125 people in person, which was amazing, especially for our first year back. But we had about 260 people online. And that's the exact kind of balance we were looking to get, you know, as we start moving forward in these hybrid events, because that's the potential of the space, is four walls, right? There's a limit. There's a finite limit to the amount of people. And that's what makes it so special and more valuable in some ways. And of course, digitally, you can have as big a scalable audience as you can reach, you know? So I was really heartened to see that happen even this year, going back to being able to be in person for something that people have gone in person to for 37 years, or well, whatever, 35 years prior to COVID.
Yeah. And there's something about that number, or the balance of those two numbers like you were talking about, that basically one is like twice as much as the other,
mm-hmm.
that I appreciate so much because it makes it feel tangible. And that's a place where I want to get to with our friends across the various district attorney's offices that we're actually helping to put on this event. This is watching them sort of understand the connection mm-hmm. to those people out there digitally.
Mm-hmm.
And how easy it is to get desensitized to big numbers on the internet. It's like $100 million or 10,000 viewers or this and that and that. And like, it's that sort of idea of like huge numbers just have no sort of connection to reality in some ways, you know, like Jeff Bezos's net worth. Like I have no sense of how much that actually is. I just know it's a very big number. But to think about like 268, you know, views on this YouTube live stream across the, you know, 4 hours that it was up. You're like, wow, that's like 268 people. That's like twice as many
humans,
as who came
right?
in person. Yeah. Like there's like a reality tether to it. It's not just like an infinite number of people. And it lets us grow. And, you know, the hope is to have as many people as possible be able to access it digitally. But to watch their eyes light up when they made the connection and to be like, yeah, we think we had about 125 in person. And it was incredible that we were able to double the number of people that came in person and like the access that they had to it because we did create and produce a live stream. That gave them access to the vigil and all of the stories and sort of the message inside of that event. And it was just like really wonderful to see them sort of have that full realization and that sort of full connection to the impact of it.
And my favorite part sometimes, I think, of all of this is that it doesn't stop, right? It's not just that 268 number. Now this video and all the individual videos of the performances and the speeches get cut apart and they go to work, you know, while the vigil committee is sleeping for the next year. And they touch people as the algorithm starts feeding it into the recommended, you know, video engine on YouTube. And I love that, especially when we're talking about impact focused stuff that we work on. I love that so much because that is like quadrupling the horsepower of this event, you know, like you just like they could not have done that and reached that many people and gotten that message out in that same way themselves or we couldn't do it on our own, you know.
Yeah, that's actually something I was so curious about as I was looking through analytics, was like, where did those 268 people come from? How did the word get out and how did they get those sort of those butts in digital seats? And I just like, because that is like, it is a big number. If you think about a room full of 250 people, you'd be like, wow, there's a lot of people here. That's great. Where they came from.
I can actually speak to a little bit of that, although of course we'll never know exactly like how they each person got pointed there. But the vigil's put on by the Downstate Coalition, which is made up of about, I think, 11 to 15 different organizations across New York State that serve victims and survivors and families of victims and survivors. And I know that each of them, this is like a great example, actually, of that grassroots organizing model that we talk about a lot with people we're working with. Each of those agencies is empowered and incentivized to get the word out, right? Because the goal of this is to provide comfort and space for as many people as possible that have been impacted by violence. So you've got those 11 or whatever it is agencies doing the work. And then I know Vilma, who's on our producing committee, she's from Safe Horizons, I believe. She got a hold of the Actors Fund and got someone to put it in their Actors Fund email, which we know from working with the Actors Fund has a pretty sizable mailing list as well. So it was like, I hadn't really thought about it until I was thinking about the answer to this. It's just a great example of like what I hope that all folks thinking about doing a digital engagement will start to really lean into, which is like activating and mobilizing the groups of people who care very much about the work you're doing, and let them help get that word out and get those digital butts in seats, like you said.
Yeah, I love that. It's got like a bit of a Captain Planet feel to it. It's like bringing together all the disparate, you know, like you were describing, even just the different district attorney offices that were like, great, we as our own entity are going to be part of this coalition, the Downstate Coalition, and reach our individual audiences and coming together. It's an interesting model too around like how to organize and develop an event itself or a thing that is worthy of live streaming, I guess, to be like, oh, let's bring a bunch of component pieces together that each have built-in audiences and cross-pollinate them all through a live digital engagement.
I wanted to ask you too on the vigil and some of those analytics that we were looking at. I know, you know, during our debrief with them, I was talking a little bit about I as user creator on YouTube, but not person that has experience with companies on the back end of YouTube the way you do. I was surprised pleasantly by the numbers in our analytics around how many times the live vigil went into the recommendation search engine with YouTube and how many people actually clicked through. And it's not so much the click through, because that is what it is. And of course, this is incredibly compelling and incredibly specific, and it impacts a lot of people. So that part I get a little more, but I did find it really interesting, those numbers for how often we were put in front of someone during those 3.5 hours that we were streaming were much, much higher than a lot of stuff I've ever put out, you know, particularly live. on YouTube. And so I wondered just if you had any thoughts about that, because you just have this different set of expertise, you know, where my my shit is like lived experience, just like trying every kind of content on YouTube.
Yeah, I was digging into them a bit yesterday and trying to, you know, the whole concept of like explain to me like I'm five.
Yeah.
Like when I'm going through analytics like these, I try to like approach it that way where I'm like, okay, you know, in the back end of YouTube, it talks about, you know, where these views come from of this live stream. And it says things like other YouTube features. And I'm like, okay, what the hell does that mean? And then, you know, you get more information about it. It says like, oh, like traffic that's within YouTube that doesn't fall into other categories, or like the browsing features. I'm like, okay, great, browsing features. What does that mean? I'm like, oh, it's the homepage or it's a subscription feed. I'm like, okay. So if I'm a user, if I'm one of these nine people who showed up via a browse feature, I went to the YouTube homepage or I somehow ended. So it's like, okay, as one of those nine people, I came into it with a certain intention of like, I'm trying to find, you know, the 37th annual New York Crime Victims Candlelight Vigil. Like, mm-hmm. Got it. That like tells me a story of those nine people and how they got there and what ways that we can play with how YouTube, you know, uses these browse features to help get people to that. But like that person or those nine people in my mind are like, they're already bought in. They're just trying to find the video. And then like the interesting one, because there's a bunch of ones like that. The channel page is kind of like that. It's like someone who's bought in who's just trying to find the video, YouTube search, someone who's bought in is just trying to find the video. But it was the suggested video ones that I was most interested in, because that's someone who is on YouTube that is not searching for the mm-hmm. Candlelight Vigil. Mm-hmm. And the numbers back here show that it was shown to 14 people and one person clicked it. Mm. But then that one person, and like I think this is the most important part, stayed for 12 minutes, right? Wow. If that one person jumped in there and watched it for 3 seconds, then that, you know, that tells doesn't me matter. What,
yeah,
what, like that doesn't matter. That person, you know, didn't actually stay for any significant amount of time. So that click doesn't count in a sense. But the fact that that person stayed for like almost 13 minutes meant that like it was compelling in a way that, yeah, like you were saying, a sort of a random person off the streets of YouTube that was suggested this video on that sort of right-hand bar, you know, back to explain to me like I'm five. It's like, hi, I'm watching a video and there's a bunch of videos off to the right side of my screen. And I see, you know, the thumbnail for Crime Victims Vigil. I'm like, what is this? I'll click that and check it out. They landed there and then they stayed for 13 minutes. 13 minutes on the internet is an insane amount of time.
Totally.
They found it compelling enough to hang around and to continue listening to the choirs or to you know, got sucked into one of the sort of crime victim survivor speeches and stories. Like that is really compelling to me. And it makes me think like, okay, what are the other ways that you can get it in front of people? And like, what's the best way to optimize that thumbnail to appeal or the title or any of those other things that could increase the number of people who are actually clicking on those and then get YouTube to drive it to more places and to then therefore generate more impressions and therefore hopefully get more people to click. And then once they land there, that's the hardest part, I think, is actually having the compelling content such that people will stay once they get there. So if that's already done, then it's easier to like tweak the model and figure out how to get people to click on it if we know that once they're there, they get captured and they continue watching.
So is that part of the iteration process that we're always talking about with live digital, that it's, you know, a longer journey than just one show, i.e. like what you're talking about is if you're thinking about or doing live digital, you take those analytics afterwards, you learn the things that you're talking about from your analytics, and then you plan differently for the next one because you know a little bit about your audience's behavior?
Yeah, exactly. Like as I read through these analytics, you know, it's telling me that the majority of people, almost 50%, came directly. So it's like, great. Like, we did a pretty good job of getting the correct URL to people in such a way where all they had to do was click it, and it brought them into the experience that they're expecting. For all those other ones, where people who went to the YouTube search or all the other YouTube features, like, that raises the question in my head of like, okay, well, why did that person go to YouTube first? Mm-hmm. Did they not realize it was on YouTube? Like, how did they end up doing that? And, like, so that's 50% of every other view. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, were there issues with the stream such that they reloaded the page and ended up on the YouTube homepage or something like that? Mm-hmm. Like that's what I try to read into of like all those other sort of views and where they came from. You know, if you came from a channel page or a browse feature, which is like the homepage of YouTube, it's like, okay, well, how did they get to the homepage or how did they get to the Downstate Vigil's channel page first? Like what were they doing and mm-hmm. why was that confusing for them? Because that's an inferior path towards the content because it requires 1 to 2 more clicks to get there. Mm. So it's like, okay, what could we have done better to get those people more quickly to the actual live stream where we want them to be and where we know once they get there, they hang around forever. Mm-hmm. But if they get lost in the shuffle because they're confused on which link to click and they try to go to YouTube, but they end up on some other random video and they don't actually ever make it, then, you know, that's someone who could have enjoyed the content that just never got there. Mm-hmm. So that's what these numbers speak to me saying, like, how do we be as clear as possible about where to go and how easiest to get there?
I think that's really cool. And for everyone working in this field, but just to bring it back specifically to the Vigil, right? We're not going to have another meeting for the Vigil till September. So we've got, well, I don't know, whatever that is, 6 months, a long time. But for us, right, when we're thinking about this, right after we're done, we're doing a bunch of work to think about what we can do different and what we can add to achieve even more of our goals for a live digital experience. And sometimes, and often, that is across, you know, how we build the broadcast, what kind of tech we're using, all the sexy stuff. But this work that you're describing, like the just like, talk to me like I'm five, where did these people come from? How did they get there? How long did they stay? Is so much more, A, than just a set of analytics on a spreadsheet. Like, it's such an important part of designing a digital experience that continues to succeed and maybe exceed your goals as a person who's putting that on. And it, you know, being able to build that brief and that breakdown while everything is fresh so that we can come back to it in September in that first meeting when we start making choices for the next time that aren't just let's do it again the exact same way, I think is just like super exciting. And is certainly, by the way, just like as a quick shout out to the Vigil Committee, is our favorite thing about working with them. They are not a group of technology native folks. I don't think they would describe themselves as that. They never sit there and tell us, no, this worked last year. Let's just do it that way. You know, like I really appreciate that about them. They're so curious and they're so excited to discover new ways to like continue. They're so mission led. I think it's something you pointed out, not in those exact words, but across all of our production meetings, that they come to the table with a spirit that is informed because by their mission led, their sense of mission for doing this. And therefore, they are so curious about how we can do it better.
Yeah, I love that. And I love too the way that like we can empower them with things like this data from the back end of YouTube to help tell them the stories around what it means and like, yeah, ways that they can change the messaging or the URL that's on the flyer that they send out. Like, they're so excited about those things. And I love, like, yeah, seeing that in their face when they like recognize and understand what this information means. And it's not just a bunch of random numbers in the YouTube back end.
And like, just to be fair, will we tell Susan all of this? And will she go, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I trust you. Let's do it. Yes, probably. But that being said, they do. They just always ask a bunch of really good questions. And I'm really excited because we haven't even talked through all of this. You're hearing all of this live and in real time on our end. So if you have any questions, you know, as you're getting your live digital stuff together around how to sort of leverage and lean into your analytics around your audience's behavior, you know where to find us. We're nerds. We want to talk about it with you.
Yeah. Maybe we should do a give back breakdown. Go back through maybe 2019's analytics. Ooh. Assuming that they're all roughly the same. It looks like they updated things in like 2015, so we're probably fine. But yeah, to do a little breakdown and to post something maybe on LinkedIn that's just like, we broke down Give Back Concerts YouTube analytics to tell you a bit more about what it means from the user behavior and stream behavior side.
I'm annoyed with how excited I am to do that. And if they change the analytics in 15, that actually means we could do 16, 18, 19. I'm curious in particular because 19 was so different. Like something changed going into 19. You know, I don't know if that's true in terms of, well, I just don't know in the scope of, in, you know, the terms that is true, but certainly it was a bigger concert. There were more people watching. The videos performed, you know, well afterwards. I don't know. I'd be really interested to see some like across the life cycle of those three concerts too. Some of the things that stayed the same and some of the things that differed.
Cool. Let's do it.
Amazing. Well, this has been a very fun episode, everyone. Thanks for joining us as per usual.
The goal of this podcast is to bring people together and have these important conversations. So share this conversation with someone who is interested in live streaming analytics and wants to learn more about them.
I'm Jess.
And I'm Joe.
And we'll see you back here next week.